Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, September 14th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
Also with us in the studio is WCAI's reporter Sarah Tan. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
And joining us later will be Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and we'll check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Let's start this week with a big story that came out at the very end of last week. Friday afternoon, word came that the Department of Interior had made a determination on the status of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe's land in trust. Sarah, tell us what this decision said and briefly what it means.
Sure. So the Department of Interior essentially said that the Wampanoag's 300 some odd acres in Mashpee and Taunton do not meet federal requirements to be held in trust. It's an unprecedented ruling because it overturns an Obama era determination that said the land was allowed to be placed in trust in 2015. And it's essentially, it's never happened before that the Department of Interior has made a reversal of a previous decision that it's made. And it's the first time that it's done this since the 1950s. So in a way, it's really hard for anyone to really know what this decision means going forward. The land still remains in trust right now because the department has no way to remove it. But basically, they have said that land does not belong there.
And we're talking about 321 acres between Mashpee and Taunton.
Yes.
Cindy, a lot of uncertainty here going forward, but for the moment, nothing is changing for the tribe?
Right. Yeah, the Interior Department says they'll keep that land in trust until a lawsuit that was brought against this casino plan for Taunton by the neighbors in Taunton is resolved. And so it's just sort of the tribe is wondering what happens next. Now, Tribal Chairman Cedric Cromwell has said repeatedly that a negative decision by the Interior Department is a step to disestablishing the reservation. So that's a really big concern. And there are the tribal vice chairwoman, Jessie Little Doe Barrard, told the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs, Tara Sweeney, this week that what she did was wrong. The actual National Congress, the American Indians, met in Washington, D.C. this week, and they actually issued objection also to the ruling.
Sarah, Cindy mentions here that it comes out of a lawsuit that's arising from the tribe's pursuit of casino on tribal lands in Taunton. Explain a little bit what happens here.
Sure. So trying not to get too into the weeds because it is fairly complex, but essentially, though the Wampanoag have a very long history as a tribe on the Cape, they were never officially recognized by the federal government until 2007. And they were able to have their land put into federal trust just 3 years ago in 2015. Since then, they've announced plans to build a casino in large part to help make up the money that it took to get federal recognition and place their land into trust to begin with. And residents of Taunton have strongly opposed their plan to build a casino. They brought a lawsuit in which they alleged that the Interior Department was not allowed to take land into trust for the Wampanoag because they were not a federally recognized tribe in 1934. Side note, they were, like many North Atlantic tribes, under state jurisdiction because of their interaction with the colonies. And so this decision is something that a lot of North Atlantic tribes are watching and are very worried about. And the Department of Interior's finding is essentially the answer to this lawsuit.
I want to touch on a couple other things quickly. One of them is that Representative Bill Keating has filed a bill that would essentially invalidate the Department of Interior's finding.
Yeah, Keating has a bill that would reaffirm the 2015 decision, so it would keep the land in trust and make it so that no other challenges could be made to the land's legitimacy. It's got bipartisan support, but the bill has not come up for a vote yet, and if it doesn't before the end of this year, it'll have to be reintroduced in Congress, and that could be much longer before it's actually passed.
And Sarah, you spoke with Cedric Cromwell this week after the decision came down. What was his reaction?
Cromwell said that the tribe is extremely worried. He felt like they and many other Native American tribes were under attack by the federal government. In a lot of ways, it sent shockwaves through many tribes nationally who had been watching this case because it essentially sets a precedent that the federal government is willing to reverse a previous decision about land and trust. And as a Native American rights lawyer told me yesterday, it puts all tribes in a very tenuous place even economically, because essentially no tribal lands are safe after this decision or this finding has been found. The department could reverse their decision on a tribe's land whenever there's an administration change.
Mm. Let's move on here. Cindy McCormick, this week saw the 17th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. You covered a ceremony in Yarmouth that focused not just on the memory of this event, but the ways that many people are still dealing with it.
Yeah, a former demolition supervisor named John Feel, who he lost part of his foot while working on what they call the pile at the World Trade Center. That was the when the Twin Towers fell. And he was a guest at and a speaker, the main speaker at the Yarmouth Police Department's ceremony on Tuesday morning. That was at their 9/11 Memorial Garden. And he talked about how there's still lingering illnesses and deaths among the first responders, the cleanup crews, people who lived in the area, people who worked in the area of Ground Zero. And that for them, 9/11 isn't over.
They had the event right there. They were at the same time talking about other people that were dealing with this.
Yes, there was a former firefighter there from New York City who talked about how he developed a rare autoimmune disease, and he was actually told it was life threatening when his wife was pregnant with her first child. But he has survived and has gone on to have three children. And also John Feel, he established the Feel Good Foundation when he was denied benefits. He founded this in 2005 to help get benefits for the people impacted by these environmental illnesses and hazards from the terrorist attack. And he estimates that about 10,000 people now have a 911 related certified cancer.
10,000 people.
Right. And then there was also Richard Palmer, who was actually with the Department of Corrections there. And he was there at the Ground Zero area because they actually ran a temporary morgue. And they did sort of like unsung hero work behind the scenes in running this morgue. And he said that the number of deaths resulting from these illnesses is going to pass the number of people who are killed actually by the terrorist attacks pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is like nearly 3,000 people. Already there have been at least 2,000 deaths.
And some of the people at this event were also just remembering the moment itself and the way that it brought the country together.
Right, yeah. And John Feel said that was something that really spoke to him, that they wishes, for all the horror, he just remembers how it brought people together, regardless of their race, religion, or politics. It brought the country together. And then the firefighter from New York City was talking about how he arrived to the towers from Flushing, and he was a probationary firefighter, and he expected to be pulling people out alive, and that didn't happen. There was just rubble, and the smoke and the heat was unbelievable. And John Feel was talking about how his work boots would melt after four hours working on the pile. So there's still a lot of people dealing not only with the traumatic memories of the time and their family losses, but actually dealing with the health impact on them right now.
Let's speak with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Bill, you've got a fascinating article looking at the record increase of car and truck traffic to the Vineyard this year. Tell us what data you were looking at and what you found.
Well, yeah, every sort of summer, just by anecdotal evidence or driving around town, you think, man, it's busier than ever here with cars and trucks. So we looked at the SSA numbers. They just came out recently, and it proved that, yes, there were a lot more cars and trucks. For the third year, there was a record-breaking amount. This for 2018, from June 1st to August 31st, there were approximately 4,000 more cars than 2017 coming across. August was the bulk of that, with 3,000 more cars in just August alone. Trucks also saw a big increase over last year, with almost 1,000 more trucks coming over. SSA General Manager Robert Davis said that the increase can be tracked directly. They put the freight ferry Sankaty into regular service this summer. Usually it's just a backup, so that brought a lot more cars and trucks over, had more boats available to it. He said that was, just to increase demand, so they brought more supply.
One thing you point out in the story that I thought was fascinating was that in 1997, voters in every island town, they passed a non-binding referendum to restrict cars carried on the steamship ferries to levels at 1995, is that right? And what happened to that?
Yeah, that's right. I think the key phrase there is the non-binding agreement. In 1995, the cars brought over were about 368,000. This is just cars. We don't have the truck numbers from back then. Compare that to 2017. This is the full year, not just the summer. So the full year in 1995, 368,000 approximately, 2017, 415,000 cars. So there was really no restriction. To compare that to more current numbers, In 2010, there were a combined number for the full year of cars and trucks about 490,000. In 2017, for the full year, 552,000. Sean Driscoll, the communications director for the SSA, said basically every year since 2010 to 2017, there were more trips added. So that's the thing. More boat trips were available, brought more stuff, which, of course, brings up the cases, breaks up the long-standing debate going back, as you mentioned, to 1997, how much is too much? And, you know, that's the tricky question, particularly during the busy summer months.
And now, right now in Woods Hole, the ferry terminal there is being rebuilt. We can see it from the studio window here. And that's going to increase capacity as well as it goes from 2 full-time working slips to 3.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And you guys will probably be hearing the construction. It's going to be a 3- to 4-year process, as you know, budgeted about $64 million. But yeah, an interesting part of that is the third slip. Now, the reconstruction of the third slip is placing it outside the scope of the previous agreements with the neighbors, saying limiting how many trips could come out of there. Now, you know, it's up to the discretion of the SSA because it's a little further out, so that, again, can bring in more trips, and that's another piece of this puzzle, which a lot of people will be looking at and talking about in the weeks and months to come.
Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times with me here. Cindy, there are questions of safety and environmental justice around the spent fuel rods at Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. Some of the activists in this discussion have different ideas about what should happen with the fuel, and the public will get a chance to hear some of this.
Yeah, the public can weigh in. There'll be a Nuclear Regulatory Commission meeting on September 25th, and it starts at 1:30, but toward the end of that, at 3:15, the public can actually dial in with their questions and concerns, because what the regulators will be hearing are plans from both the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station owner Entergy and prospective buyer Holtec on their plans for decommissioning. Now, the plant is scheduled to close in June, and Entergy wants to transfer the Pilgrim license to Holtec by the end of 2019. Entergy has sort of a much less aggressive approach to decommissioning the plant. They favor this kind of safe store approach that could stretch the cleanup up to 60 years, whereas Holtec wants to get in there, move all 4,000 radioactive spent fuel rods, put them in concrete dry casks within 3 years, and finish all the decommissioning work within 8 years.
So they have a much quicker timeline for all this, and they think they can do it and turn a profit at it.
Yes, and of course, this is satisfying Plymouth Town officials who want to see this 1,600-acre property cleaned up and ready for reuse. People who are, you know, the watchdogs watching this have some concerns. Mary Lampert of the Pilgrim Watch said, what if a Holtec runs out of money? I mean, this is an aggressive plan. It's going to cost money. How do you make sure that this plan actually moves forward and this place gets cleaned up as quickly as possible? Now, Holtec is working with regulators right now with plans for an interim storage facility in New Mexico. It will be called High Store. And this is part of the selling point with Plymouth Town officials, because what they would do is their plan to move those spent fuel rods to High Store and get them out of Plymouth.
And there's some question about how feasible that is and how fast that might happen.
And how fast, because that needs approval. That needs, you know, obviously federal approval.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, tell us what you have for us this week here.
So one story that we were following this week regarding a situation that's developing in South Chatham, where residents here say that the intersection of Route 137 and 28 is a safety hazard. And in fact, they called it a pedestrian nightmare. And they're petitioning the Board of Selectmen to put a crosswalk there with a pedestrian crossing signal as well. Now, currently, there are sidewalks on the south side of Route 28, but they end on the south side just east of the intersection and start on the north side just east of the intersection, and there's no way for anyone to get across that roadway safely. There's no crosswalk. It's complicated by the fact that there's a curve in the road right at that spot, so pedestrians really take their lives in their hands when they try to cross at that location. And another factor is that up Route 137 from that intersection is the Chatham Spur of the Cape Cod Rail Trail. and bicyclists from South Chatham are trying to get up there have to cross Route 28 at that point, and again, it's dangerous. Now, last week, the South Chatham Village Association voted unanimously to send this petition to the Board of Selectmen. And the biggest hurdle in all this is that Route 28 is, of course, a state highway, and the town really has no authority to make any improvements on its own. Public Works Director Tom Temple said that he's made some inquiries to the state, but he actually welcomed this petition and said it will provide the support that he needs to convince both the Board of Selectmen and perhaps the state Mass Highways to take some action here. But he was under really no illusion that this would get done soon, that it'd have to be scheduled and funding located. But he said he planned to approach the Board of Selectmen about this, and the Village Association members are happy that something's going to be done, although they're not happy that it could take a while, and they're planning to put pressure where they can to make this situation happen.
Tim, I want to ask you about another story out of Chatham this week. A man was found drowned in Chatham Harbor. Tell us what happened here and what you know.
Well, the details are still sort of sketchy about what happened. What we do know is that 44-year-old Louis Guarnacina of Newburyport, he also has a house here in Chatham, was out on his 24-foot Carolina skiff near the North Inlet. And like I said, we don't know exactly what happened. It was a foggy day. The surf was heavy. And something happened on the boat. The skiff was found floating upside down, and Mr. Guarnacina's body was located nearby by a crew on the Barnstable County dredge, which is getting ready to clear shoals from that inlet. State police, Cape and Islands District Attorney, and the Environmental Police are investigating this. What they're saying is clearly an accident. What we learned about Mr. Guarnacina is that he was a founder of a high-tech company up in Beverly called High Res Bio Solutions. And according to that company's CEO, Peter Harris, he was a brilliant engineer who had developed some innovative methods for using modular robotics in biotech and pharmaceutical labs. And he was also a devoted to his family and a very avid fisherman with a lot of experience on the water. Mr. Harris said that whenever Mr. Guarnacina wasn't with his family or working, he was out fishing, mm-hmm. and his Facebook page is just full of photos of him displaying tuna and striped bass and other fish that he'd caught. And Mr. Harris said this tragedy was a real loss, not just to their company but also to the industry, which apparently Mr. Guarnacina was a key player in. And it was, you know, also a tragedy for the town. But it highlighted, according to Stu Smith, the harbor master, that the inlets in Chatham can be very dangerous. And anybody who's going out, even in fair weather, needs to really know the area and be cautious about where they're going and what's happening around them. We don't know at this point if Mr. Guarnacina was wearing a life jacket. But obviously, Mr. Smith said that that's something that people really need to be cognizant of at this point.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Cindy McCormick is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, the state has offered guidance on school resource officers. These are essentially police officers in the school, right?
And more schools are hiring school resource officers in the wake of shootings at schools, and because they're seen as providing an important safety role as well as a modeling role for children. But one thing this state model says is they should not be enforcing routine discipline, that this should be left in the hands of the school disciplinarians, whether it's the principal or assistant principal, and also they should not be taking over the work of the mental health providers. And this was a model issued by three state agencies, the Attorney General, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, and the Executive Office of Safety and Public Safety and Security.
And the Cape and Islands District Attorney, Michael O'Keefe, weighing in here, he had some critical things to say about the guidelines.
Yeah, this was part of this came from a bill that was passed by the legislature in April to overhaul the state criminal justice system. This was just a small part of it, but O'Keefe objected to this part of it. He said, first of all, the guidance for the school resource officers wasn't necessary because they want to help and not arrest kids. But he also said that he disagreed with part of the law that changed, interesting, it changed the definition of a delinquent child, and it raised the arrestable age from 7 to 12. Also said you can't make an arrest on several, first arrest on several offenses, which include making annoying phone calls and disorderly conduct. And it was interesting because O'Keefe said that juvenile court judges have expressed to police and prosecutors that, you know, in some cases they do want the child arrested, and they'll let the court, you know, when necessary, and then when they see it's necessary, when the police and prosecutors see it's necessary, and then let the court sort it out.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, O'Keefe and a number of other people weighing in here about what a positive impact it can be to have one of these resource officers in the school.
Right. And like I said, more and more schools are hiring them, both for the safety aspect. You'll pass by schools and you'll see an officer standing, you know, outside the school, maybe even the road, or right out, you know, right outside their front door.
And the kids really know these officers.
And the kids get to know the officers. And the whole goal is for them to get to trust them and be able to talk to them and see them as a helpful, an authority figure, but a helpful authority figure.
We're going to speak now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, a town meeting article is looking to give voters more say in large-scale projects. Explain what's happening here.
Okay, it's actually a pair of articles, two separate special town meeting articles that will be included within the warrant of the October 10th special town meeting out here on Nantucket. The first one has been filed by the Nantucket Coastal Conservancy, which is an advocacy group for protecting the public beaches on the island that was originally formed as an opposition group to a large-scale erosion project on the island's east end. And what they're looking to do is take some of that decision-making authority for these erosion control projects out of the hands of the town select board and put it back in the hands of town meeting. This proposal comes in the wake of a non-binding ballot question that was promoted by the Coastal Conservancy that passed overwhelmingly at a recent town meeting that authorized the town or asked whether the town should take appropriate action to preserve island beaches as open space. And in light of this erosion control project, which the select board recently voted to send along to the Conservation Commission here with an expansion proposal. So those are sort of the underlying factors. What the Coastal Conservancy says is that there is already wording on the books here that large-scale erosion projects on public property have to go before a town meeting, but that the select board in this case got around it by calling it a public-private partnership, and this new article would tighten up that language. Some select board members, not particularly pleased with this, they feel that, in the words of select board member Matt Fee, it usurps the power of the select board, and that the idea of requiring contentious issues to be brought before a town meeting really oftentimes removes the nuances inherent in them and kind of compresses the time frame and how they can be negotiated and discussed, and that town meeting often tends to be more emotional than rational and quantitative, and these kind of issues really need the discussion and the investigation that the select board can provide. There's a second article that has been filed by an Okawa Avenue resident, Patrick Tafe, who wants to see the island voters have more direct say in the installation of private sewer lines on public property, and as an extension, and more importantly to him, in the future development of the island. He sponsored an article that would require town meeting approval for any private sewer lines or other sewer equipment that goes beneath the town's roads or on town property to be approved by town meeting. Right now, it's approved by the Board of Sewer Commissioners with recommendations from the sewer department. And there's a number of private developments around the island that have, in the past, with that permission, installed sewer lines that at some point run beneath town streets before connecting to a municipal sewer main or the sewer plant. And it's also been proposed by the controversial 40B project out here right now, mm-hmm. Surfside Crossing, to put their own line in from that development directly to the sewer plant, which has the capacity, the experts and the consultants say, to handle the wastewater from the development, but the lines themselves, the public lines, do not. So Mr. Tafe says that it's not particularly about that project, although it is in some ways related, but really more about giving the voters a say in how public resources are used, potentially for private gain.
Josh, another story in the Inky Mirror this week, popular downtown restaurant and bar that's been closed for more than a decade could be reopening next summer.
It is expected to. The Tap Room, which for more than 35 years was located in the basement of the Jared Coffin House Inn right in downtown Nantucket, that closed in 2006. Nantucket Island Resorts, which owns the inn, got approval from the planning board Monday night to reopen that popular restaurant. It was a really big gathering spot for both islanders and visitors for more than three decades, but it was closed in 2006 and decommissioned in 2007 when NIR did a lot of work on the hotel, and they were told they'd have to bring up the restaurant to code, and they had some other plans at the time, so they decided not to do that. But now they're moving forward with it. They're going to, they say they plan to reopen it in its former glory, I guess, convert some of the upstairs of the inn where the current restaurant is, indoor part of the restaurant, to guest rooms, and the popular steakhouse Nantucket Prime, which has a large patio restaurant in the summer season, will continue to operate as well, and the operators of Prime will run the tap room, the Nantucket Island Resort says.
Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Panel is meeting again. It's just the second meeting since the Trump administration started up. And I guess there's some lingering concern about whether it will be able to continue meeting.
Yeah, normally the local advisory panel meets 4 to 6 times a year. That's been basically how often it meets since the seashore was established in 1961 and this panel was created. And the panel members are from the 6 towns within the seashore range, and they advise the seashore superintendent and as well as the Department of Interior. Now, this is only their – but when the Trump administration came into power, it suspended all federal advisory commissions for review until further notice. Now, after 15 months and much lobbying by local officials and legislators, they were allowed to meet in June. So this September 24th meeting will be their second meeting this year.
Now, this advisory panel is being watched because advisory panels across the country have been facing the same difficulty about being unable to meet. And the Seashores Advisory Commission was actually the first in the country set up.
Yes, and then this and this is an important part of people see this as an important part of citizen input into into a federal agency, and it seems to have worked well for decades. And now the panel members are saying, yeah, they're meeting September 24th, but they don't know if they'll be allowed to meet again this year. And they also the clock is ticking. There is a deadline for reauthorization that actually comes 2 days after their September 24th meeting. Now, Congressman William Keating filed a bill on April to extend reauthorization until 2028. And he said, don't be concerned if this legislation isn't passed by September 26th, because he said in the past, the authorization has lapsed and then been renewed. But as you mentioned, these are unusual times in that these federal advisory commissions have been suspended.
And issues that they're going to be talking about, I know they're going to be talking about a campground in North Truro and some illegal tree cutting going on. And those are some of the things that we'll be talking about in the next upcoming meeting. We're going to speak right now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be with you.
Ed, Wellfleet is joining a handful of other towns across the region in adopting a residential tax exemption. And this comes not without a fair amount of discussion. Tell us what this is about.
Okay. Well, this is the time of year when all of the towns in the Commonwealth, their selectmen, have to make certain decisions about how the local property tax will be allocated. And it's a requirement of the state, really. They have to decide, for example, whether commercial property will be taxed at the same rate as residential. One of the options that municipalities have is this residential tax exemption, which allows residents of the town to apply for an exemption on their primary residence. And the Wellfleet selectmen voted this week to adopt this policy at a 20% exemption rate. And they thus join a few other towns: Provincetown, Truro, Barnstable, Tisbury, Nantucket, and Somerset all have adopted it. I believe that there are now 16 municipalities across the state that have done so. The way it works is the math is a little bit complicated, so bear with me here. It allows residents who are considered domiciled residents, that is, they can show that their primary residence is in the town, to get an exemption that is equal, in this case, say 20%, is equal to 20% of the average assessed value of residential property in the town. So, for example, let's say the average property is valued at $500,000. a 20% exemption would then amount to $100,000, mm-hmm. or 20% of $500,000. And so when it's time to pay your property tax, $100,000 is deducted from the value of your property, and then you pay tax on the remainder.
And,
so
and it's made up by increasing a tax elsewhere on non-residential property owners. Is that right?
Right, on non-residents or on second homeowners.
Right. I'm sorry, yes.
The state law requires that this be a revenue-neutral policy. So the deduction, the tax break that people, residents get, must be offset by increasing the tax on other residential property. This is the origin of the controversy. And it is an emotional issue in many ways, more than an actual dollars and cents issue, because the amount of money that we're talking about is not a lot. For example, the amount that a resident would save under this policy would be around $600 or $700. And the amount that a non-resident would have to pay extra might be anywhere from $100 to $300. But the problem is that some non-residents or second homeowners feel that this is a way of punishing them or treating them like second-class citizens. And in some places, in Truro and in Provincetown in particular, the part-time resident taxpayers associations have lobbied very vociferously against this policy, and have even, in some cases, threatened to retaliate by not supporting local charities and that kind of thing. And in the discussion in Wellfleet this week, one of the selectmen, Jerry Haug, actually mentioned that. He said, "I don't think this is a good idea. I'm very torn," he said, "but I don't want to be against the non-residents. Mm-hmm. What if they stop contributing to our charities?" Three of the five selectmen voted for it. Justina Carlson was one. She said the state offers this option because it's a mechanism to make the tax law more fair. And it is a progressive tax mm-hmm. policy, in that the largest benefit goes to the owners of the least costly properties. The benefit actually goes down as the value of your property goes up. So, and Janet Reinhardt, who's the chair of the Selectmen in Wellfleet, noted that the policy is widely recommended by municipal experts as a way to help low-income people. And she predicted that many more towns would be adopting it in the coming year. She also noted at a meeting earlier this summer that the Massachusetts Municipal Association recommended it as a way to help people who are having a hard time paying their taxes and making it in places where the value of real estate outstrips the opportunities for people to make a living, which is certainly true on the Outer Cape.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, town of Barnstable has come to a decision about non-retail recreational marijuana businesses. And this came at the end of some long discussions and a little bit of drama.
Yeah. Well, if recreational marijuana is a political football, there were some interesting plays by the Barnstable Town Council this week. And the Barnstable Town Council voted Thursday on an amendment to create a small zone in the so-called Medical Gateway section of Hyannis. That's near West Yarmouth. And they'll allow non-retail operations there, such as cultivators, research facilities, and independent testing laboratories. What you won't find are the recreational sales shops.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay. So it was interesting because those who favor these retail shops for recreational marijuana say that the counselors sort of did an end run, or accusing the counselors of doing an end run around them. For instance, Jessica Rapp Grassetti of Kootuit, who was a councilwoman, she originally voted no on the amendment, which gave people like Christopher Gagne of West Barnstable, he's a community liaison for the Somerville-based Cannabis Community Care and Research Network, the mistaken impression that it was okay to leave because this was going to be taken up at a later date. But within half an hour, Rapp Grassetti called for a vote of reconsideration. She changed her vote to yes, which gave the amendment the necessary two-thirds supermajority of 9-4 that they needed to change the zoning.
So there's some question about the procedure of how this all went down.
Right. And so, yeah, so it was, and Gagne said, all of us who attended were on time and presented ourselves respectfully, and they wanted to be part of the discussion. And he said that it was underhanded the way that they did this after we left. Now, the town councilors who are in favor of this says that this puts the power in the hands of the town. They won't be subject to any interference as to how they can have these facilities in their town. And a temporary moratorium on recreational marijuana sales is in effect in Barnstable through 2018. So a decision did need to be made by December 31st as to whether the town would regulate or ban sales after the moratorium ends.
And they go on to point out that it can be modified once they have this on the books.
Right.
So they needed to get something on the books
right now.
We are going to speak right now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, two island towns held a joint meeting this week. They were discussing shared town services and funding for human services. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so Oak Bluffs and Tisbury got together to talk about how they could share services. Both towns, small towns here on the island, and they struggle to attract sometimes people who can do these top jobs, and particularly jobs that require some specific licenses and education and things like that. One of them being building commissioner, for example. Well, Tisbury does have a building commissioner in place right now. Oak Bluffs has kind of struggled to get someone in that job. And what they're thinking is, and they agreed to do, is to look at hiring one building commissioner for the two towns and then having a local inspector in each town. It would also help with things like vacation. I remember about a year ago, Tisbury had to sit down and allow a few people to be paid for their vacation time because they simply weren't able to take their time. Mm-hmm. There was nobody to fill in to do things like building inspections or, get permits approved for building projects. And, of course, construction over here seems to be happening nonstop on a daily basis. So there are a lot of projects, both residential, commercial, that take a lot of time, and some of these offices only have one person doing it. There are other things that they've talked about, looking at things like, sharing animal control services, grant writing, things like that. So the two town administrators are going to get together, see what makes sense, what doesn't, and the two towns are expected to meet again soon. We have a bit of breaking news in this regard. One of the things they talked about was police departments, but Tisbury did, in fact, hire a new police chief last night. So I don't think they're going to be combining police departments anytime soon, but maybe some services between the two departments that make sense, things like animal control, as I said.
I want to ask you to update us briefly on another story. The Supreme Judicial Court, it's the highest court in the state, heard a case this week involving Laura Marshard, and she was an assistant district attorney on the island who was in the news earlier this year when she was found guilty of misconduct. Bring us up to date on this.
That's right. This goes back to when she was a prosecutor at Edgartown District Court. The case goes back several years ago now, where she interviewed a witness without the witness's attorney being present. That's what it all boils down to. Long hearing over 8 days in Boston over a year ago, was finally found guilty of misconduct on one of three complaints that were brought against her, and that particular panel suggested a reprimand for her. The Board of Bar Overseers reviewed the case, and they upped the punishment to a one-month suspension and wanted her to go before not go before an ethics panel, but to go to an ethics course. And so now it's in the hands, the Board of Bar Overseers makes that recommendation, but it's a single justice of the Supreme Judicial Court that will make the final determination on what Laura Marchard's punishment, if anything, will be. And so there was a hearing in Boston this week, very brief hearing. Both sides were able to give a few minutes of oral argument, but they both submitted their written case as well. And the judge actually asked for some more documentation. So we expect a decision. We don't know when exactly to expect a decision, but it's in the judge's hands, and we'll see what happens with this. An interesting side note on this is all along the way, Cape and Islands District Attorney Michael O'Keefe has backed this particular prosecutor. He told our reporter at the courthouse that day that in his 36 years as a prosecutor, he has never seen an assistant district attorney face such sanctions, but he would not comment any further.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for that.
Thanks, Steve. Enjoy the weekend. Looks like a good one.
It does. Cindy McCormick is with me here in the studio. Cindy, for a number of years, trees around the Cape region have been decimated by winter moths. They've done real damage. Doug Frazier has an interesting article this week about how we may be breaking the cycle now of winter moths. And really, it sounds like it's thanks to one person.
Right. Now, flights by the state's Forest Health Program in 2016 and 2017 have shown no winter moth defoliation in eastern Massachusetts. So that's good news because they outpace the gypsy moths as far as stripping the forest. They took out 62,000 acres, stripped them of leaves statewide in 2015 compared to about 38,000 by the gypsy moths. And this, yes, this this good news for the forest, sort of vanishing or lessening of the winter moth is the work of Joseph Elkington, a University of Amherst, Massachusetts entomologist who spearheaded a biological control campaign against the winter moths. And he's been using flies to do this for the past 14 years, and it seems to be taking effect.
These are parasitic flies.
And he had to really push to get these introduced because different politicians in the state were like, no, we've got a tight budget. We can't afford to do this. But he's, well, you know, the forests are at stake. You know, they provide the oxygen and our actual forests are at stake. And so finally, the U.S., with the help of also Cape legislators, the U.S. Department of Agriculture provided money, and the Joint Base Cape Cod provided a lab to do work with these parasitic flies.
And he's been doing this work for a long time, just kind of quietly, and it's slowly built to a point where the population of parasitic flies has now sort of shifted and taken over so that the winter moths are being driven back.
Right. And these are the winter moths that would come out when the temperatures really plummet, and then you've got those frosts, and then all of a sudden these moths appear, and they will, like, you know, just flutter around the headlights in your car and the street lamps. But the real danger is what they did to the trees, the weakening the trees. And Elkington said that the thing is the private sector can never do something like this. There's not a profit to be made if we don't do it. You know, if they didn't get the government money to do this, it won't happen. And there's other good news because the gypsy moth, there seems to be a fungus that's, you know, also, you know, decimating their ranks. So that things are, there's actually some, that's, it's nice to hear some good environmental news.
It is nice. I want to ask you about a question on November's ballot. It's an initiative to limit the number of patients that a nurse can be assigned. It's a state ballot initiative. You've got an article looking at how hospitals in the region are pushing back against it.
Yeah, there's a big campaign going on by both sides. One side is the hospital executives, and the other side is the Massachusetts Nurses Association, the state's biggest nurses union, which helped write this ballot question. Which it's on the ballot. It's called Question One, and it would call for certain nurse staffing ratios. They say it's to keep patients safe. However, the hospital executives across Massachusetts, including on Cape Cod, released a statement on Wednesday that opposed Question One on the ballot. And they said that it's going to cost them millions of dollars and result in beds closing. They say that Stephanie Nadalny, who is at Spalding Cape Cod, she's vice president of operations there, said that this will drive up the demand for nurses, will drive up salaries. They won't be able to afford it, and they won't be able to take in as many patients. And also, that it would cost them millions. over at Cape Cod Healthcare, which runs Cape Cod and Falmouth hospitals, are saying they would have to hire over 200 nurses, and this would not be within their budget.
Advocates in favor of the initiative definitely have their own studies to trot out, and they point to California, which has a similar law, and saying that this law can work. And it
right, and they're saying in California, sort of all boats rose with them, that they're saying that the MNA official was saying, David Schildmeier was saying that what happened in California was that he said that they spent less money on what he called the bean counters, and the people who are like the administrative level people, they actually provided more hands-on care. And the MNA also is supporting a report that says that will cost Massachusetts hospitals $47 million if question one passes, which is just a fraction of the $1.3 billion that hospitals executives say it would cost for the first year.
Some hard news this week at Cape Cod Potato Chip in Hyannis, as more than 20 people were laid off there.
Yeah, this is the employees got the bad news at the resort and conference center in Hyannis on Wednesday, and they laid off 21 of the 80 employees who are employed at the Breeds Hill Road facility in Hyannis, as well as 5 warehouse positions off Cape.
And to what did they attribute the layoffs?
Well, now this Cape Cod Potato Chips is now owned by Campbell's, and they said it's a business decision, and they're going to move some of the production lines. Actually, they're going to cut production lines from 3 to 1 and eliminate some older equipment and fryers. And this was not what people had hoped for in the past, because just last year, the Cape Cod Commission had approved a 17,000-square-foot addition to the facility, a $20 million project that would have expanded it and also increased that, because tourists go there and school children go there to view the potato chip making of this this Cape Cod brand, and then that was sold. This became part of Campbell's, and they said that this is not part of the business plan. They said they do want to make some improvements to the tourist area, but they said this is not this big $20 million.
So that proposed expansion is kind of in limbo, or it's not part of their plan,
right?
The town of Yarmouth and the offshore wind company Vineyard Wind are engaged in negotiations around paying for the negotiations for a host community agreement for a transmission power cable to come ashore in Lewis Bay. They met again this week.
Yeah, there's some hard bargaining going on. The Yarmouth Selectmen Tuesday rejected a second offer by the wind farm company, Vineyard Wind, to cover the costs of negotiating an agreement to allow a high-wattage transmission cable to come ashore from Lewis Bay at New Hampshire Avenue. And this would be, the cable would be carrying the, would be stemming from the wind farm turbines south of Martha's Vineyard, then once it hit land, would travel to a substation in Barnstable. Now, the Selectmen, now, in August, Vineyard Wind offered $10,000. The selectman said, "No way. Mm-hmm. This is going to cost us tens of thousands to just work out this agreement. I mean, not to work out the agreement, but to set up the process for working out an agreement, to approach this agreement." And the Board of Selectmen authorized staff to accept $50,000 to cover legal and consulting costs. But the Yarmouth officials said that Vineyard Wind they were in the ballpark, but there were too many restrictions on how the money could be spent.
But they feel like they are still moving towards negotiating.
They're negotiating. Vineyard Wind said that they would spend up to $75,000 on working out a host agreement for what it's calling the first commercial scale wind farm project. There's also some concerns about it coming ashore at all on Lewis Bay. Some West Yarmouth Residents Neighborhood Association are saying this is way too fragile. They want it to go on ashore at Covell Beach in Centerville.
And they feel like if the town engages in this host agreement, then it will almost certainly come through Lewis Bay.
Right.
It would be a done deal. Option.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, there are some Yarmouth residents who say that the wind company is actually willing to work with town officials to actually sort of protect oyster beds and make things a little bit better and, protect them from the trenches being built. And they're arguing it could be a win-win situation all around.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Cindy.
You're welcome.
And we spoke to Sarah Tan, WCAI's own reporter, and Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Ed Miller joined us from the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.